now, back to Cofield and Company in the Findlay Toyota studio.
John Von Tobel in as the company today. Cofield on the road in Boise getting ready for the 6 p.m. tip. UNLV is at no more Taco Bell Arena. Now it's Extra Mile Arena here in Boise as the Broncos host the Rebels. Big Five time.
Battle Born Injury Lawyers presents the Big Five at Four. Number five.
Very nice story, JVT. Just came down. Josh Jacobs, rookie running back with the Raiders, just bought his dad a house. This nice. Is cool. It's a nice story, especially considering the fact that Josh Jacobs was not affluent. Hell, at one point, he didn't have a house or apartment or anything to live in, and they were sleeping in a car. So this is a hell of a turnaround, quite an accomplishment. Nice gesture by Josh Jacobs buying a house for his father.
Yes, 100%. I don't think there's anything really you can poke holes in. The way that we like to do here. Yes. I've always wanted to kind of do something like this, but I have been a penniless fool for the most part of my adult life. So,
yeah, what's going on here? He's 24, you're 28. You haven't purchased your parents anything significant?
You know, I chose the wrong career path. It's funny, I actually saw an article today about like...
I could have been an NFL running back, but I decided to do sports talk.
Or just like, you know, it's like a general, just different career field overall. Like,
you should have stayed as a freaking barista. You'd be probably, you'd be like a regional manager right now.
People would be surprised how much money I made as a barista. well, so let's just put it this way. Like, the career field is great that I am in. I love every second of it. It's not exactly like you start in on the deep end of the pool when it comes to how much you make. It was a great time producing your show and working at Target at the same time. Put it that way.
It's a struggle. It's a struggle. You got to work your way up. It paid off for you. Now you have a big-time job doing national radio on satellite for VSiN.
Yes, that is
true.
It can
happen to anyone.
And I will say this. So it's not like I'm poor anyway, by the way. Like, I like my life.
And you come from a very wealthy family, and you have a school and a park named after you.
That's right, but I refuse to dip into that fund.
Yet.
That's true. I need something coming up here pretty quick. But I will say, when it comes to buying your parents stuff, I exploited a loophole this Christmas. And I think this is really interesting. Because it's not so much, especially now that I have my first child, it's not so much about what you get them. It's what you get them and what it means. So what I mean by that is, for example, my dad, I couldn't think of what to get him. And I didn't really have a lot of money to spend. So what I did was I bought a small photo album and filled it up with pictures of my son and him and the family that I already had, hit it out of the park.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. So, like, you know, I figured the next 2 years or so I'm going to hit the sentimental gifts that'll be somewhat cheap. That's a good loophole. I'm in.
That is a good loophole. Then what are you going to do after that? It's time to buy a house.
Well, so
you better pick it up.
I'm hoping I'm rich by then. So we'll revisit it in 2 years.
All right, next up.
Number four.
So CES is in town, so we see all these new cool products being introduced. Did you see the latest little robot assistant thing called Bally? It's basically a ball that just rolls around your house and I guess can do stuff for you.
I don't know if
I'm intrigued enough to add any more technology. I don't know. I didn't see a whole lot out of Bally, who appears to be like half of, I guess it's BB-8?
Yes.
From Star Wars?
Yes, that is very true. Also, I watched the video in silence. I thought it was Bali or about like Bally. I didn't realize that it was actually just ball with IE on the end, so that's good.
It's just a woman who's got Bali around. She's like, hey, Bali. Well, see ya, Bali.
What is it supposed to do? That's just what I don't. Other than follow you around and scan your body every 5 seconds and send it back to either Russia or whoever else is monitoring me, the FBI, like, what is he supposed to do?
I think isn't there another issue in this? Because I think Bali sets up like some little like workout TV, stretching TV.
Yeah.
For his master, it's a woman.
Ooh.
Aren't we going back to the Peloton thing? Does she really want to stretch? Is this ball, I don't know. Have they programmed this ball with toxic masculinity?
Bali's trying to send a message to its already attractive owner that hey, not attractive enough. We're watching.
You need to be more flexible. Now, she wasn't working out. She was just stretching. So I think they walked towards the Peloton outrage, but they didn't officially go Peloton route.
So I guess it's supposed to, like in the video, it sees a mess that the dog made and has the little rover clean it up and then sets up the workout station for her because I'm assuming she works out at the same time every day. It's very presumptuous of Bali. Like, I get it, but don't do it unless I ask, okay?
Gentle nut. I mean, at some point, I think if females are featured in these commercials, working out, people are going to be just irate and triggered over Bali. One story says Bali can be used as a personal fitness assistant, as you mentioned, can be used to operate smart home devices such as TVs or vacuum cleaners. Okay. And it can act as a companion to real pets at home. Okay, now I'm getting it.
It's kind of freaky.
My cat's my one cat is all freaked out and crazy, so maybe she could use a Bali.
You gonna wake up in the middle of the night and Bali's like cleaning your kitchen or something?
Turns what if around, Bali has a way to clean the cat? What if the cat's cleaning Bali? The cats like to clean each other. So what if a cat just starts licking Bali? And okay, we're getting too far.
This is where it gets ridiculous. This is Black Mirror territory.
Number three.
Oops, sorry. Got too much into the licking angle on that one. San Diego State. Boy, if you told people at the end of the Aztec season, it was a very good season. Again, one of the top 3-4 programs in the Mountain West Conference, that they'd have a little upheaval a few weeks after the season. Rocky Long is gone. Rocky Long, and it's weird, isn't it, John? Rocky Long retired today.
Yeah.
But he also made a trip to Syracuse to interview there for the defensive coordinator position. So what's happening here? Did he basically come to his senses? He's like, I'm not going to be a DC again, but if you're not going to pay me what I deserve, I'm retiring. Is that what happened?
It kind of sounds like it. Like, so my initial thought was, when he was shopping around himself to go to be a DC, I thought, okay, maybe he just doesn't want to be a head coach and everything that it entails, and kind of doesn't want to retire yet but wants to take a step back. But like, being a coordinator is still a lot of work, so it's not really like an insane departure from a head coach, just less press conferences and media obligations. So I immediately went to that. Like, there's something with the money. He probably wants to get paid more. He rightfully deserves it. Like, they didn't have the best year this year by his standards, but they were still very good and won a bowl game. And so it just seems like he's like, look, if you don't want to pay me enough, I'm not going to go be, you know, a defensive coordinator somewhere. I'm just going to get out of here. And I don't know, would I be surprised if in like a year he pops up again? Not really. I don't think this is
not
one
at
of
all.
Those, right? Like, this isn't one of those, like, I'm done with the game kind of deals.
John, I wouldn't be surprised if someone comes at him, if there were still a Power 5 opening, you know, a Power 5 job comes open as a DC, and someone will pay him $1.2 million, which is, you know, what many of the coordinators are getting now at the Power 5 level. Yep. I think he could take a job in 2 weeks.
Yep.
They tried to make this look like a nice thing. Thanks, Rocky, for all you did. He's the second all-time leading winner in San Diego State football history with the 81-38 record. But this doesn't mesh that he was just – he was just interviewing for other jobs and now he's retiring. Like, hey, I guess he's just done with football. He's not done. Brady Hoke, by the way, will take over, so we'll see how that works out. He was at San Diego State. He was at San Diego State for 1 year. He's had a really weird career.
That
he was
two
at Ball
seasons.
State. It was two seasons, yeah. You're right. Because first season was, what, 4-8, and I think second season he took him to a bowl game after they'd been out of the bowl mix for a long time. Before that, he was at Ball State. Am I correct on that?
Yeah,
Ball State, right? And he lost most of the time and then had one big year and got plucked by San Diego State, and then obviously he left San Diego State to go over to Michigan. So we'll see how Brady Hoke works out. The other job that's fascinating, if you're Mississippi State and you fire a coach who's been on the job for 2 years and you give him a $7 million buyout, right, in Joe Moorhead, don't you have to have the next guy ready to go like the next day?
Yeah.
Joe Judge, I think, was one of their targets. Now, I'm reading today that Mike Leach has interviewed. How do you not know that you're getting Joe Judge or you're getting Mike Leach, like, immediately? How can this drag on any bit of time?
I have no idea, especially when, like, you kind of saw it coming with Moorhead. Like, he came on to be the offensive guy. Your offense the year prior, not, you know, this 2019, but 2018, was garbage, despite all you had coming back, and your defense led the way. This year, you couldn't figure out a quarterback. Like, you saw it coming. Moorhead, it wasn't his thing. So if you were ready to buy him out, I'm with you. Like, you should have been ready. You should have your guy. And let's do, like, one of two things here with Leach. One, he's not going to take the job. We do this, it seems like, every single year with Leach. The other is, if he does, I'm going to go out on a limb. I think he would get smoked in the SEC. I'm not sure if Leach is really... Like, I'm not sure if I would buy into Leach over at Mississippi State.
You think the goal of scoring 65 points and not playing a whole lot of defense rolls well in the SEC?
I don't think so. And especially when the one team that has had your number since you have gone to the conference is Washington, which is like the best comparison, I would think, to what you're going to see in the SEC for the most part, smokes you year in and year out. And again, you had no answer for the way that they play. I don't think it would do you very well to hire him.
Next up.
Number two.
We'll get to Mike McCarthy and his intro press conference in just a little bit. Joe Judge will be introduced tomorrow. Heavily mocked on by much of the sports media, which I didn't exactly get. But, yeah, the Giants head coach rumored one to be bringing on Brett Bielema, who's former Arkansas, former Wisconsin coach, as his DC. Now, who will be the offensive coordinator, John? Is it ridiculous to think that it could be Jason Garrett?
I don't think it'd be ridiculous. They seem.
I mean, from Garrett's standpoint.
Oh. I mean, no. Who wants him as head coach? I mean, isn't this just like the natural point for him at this, like right now in his career?
No. I think next year, you wait 1 year.
Yeah.
And I mean, he's got one big advantage. Yeah. I mean, look at Mike McCarthy, right? He was heavily coveted this year. And, you know, not to make light of it, but certainly as a Caucasian, Jason Garrett will probably get a second chance.
Complexion helps. Yeah, but see, I think
so. Isn't it a step down? Why is he going to? He shouldn't even consider this. Wait, you just made $30 million.
Well, here's two things. So, one, I think the difference between him and Mike McCarthy is Mike McCarthy rode the coattails of an insanely hot quarterback to a Super Bowl. So people forget the year off, how bad he was, and just say, "Hey, Super Bowl, he was cool. Let's get him." With Jason Garrett, the other part of being offensive coordinator is he could do what he did when he was OC for Wade Phillips, and that would be hamstring the offense until you get your guy fired and then take over as interim and then eventually get the job. So.
Top story.
Number one.
I don't think you and I have talked about Monday Night Football or the announcers on Monday Night Football ever, so I have no idea what your take is except for what you sent me today. So it appears what's going to happen on Monday Night Football, they're going to have a change of management, and that could mean both the announcers, Joe Tessitore and Booger McFarland, go bye-bye?
Yeah, so a new producer is going to take over for Monday night. And just like a general manager who comes in, usually producers on these sort of things will want their own people, their own play-by-play and color analysts. And so the thought is, with the new producer, that the team is going to change again. Now, before I make my statement here, let me just say that I do think that Joe Tessitore and Booger McFarland aren't very good. They say things that are very obvious. There's a lot of shallow analysis. You know, but nobody watches football for the analysts, right? You just watch the game. Most people watch it on mute. But here's the thing.
Well, let's break in. Who watches the game?
In terms of like,
is it a bunch of football nerds and media people who make up most of the audience on Monday Night Football, or is it like 90% casual fans?
Of course.
So I want to build on this with the, hey, Joe and Booger say a lot of obvious things. Yeah, you know why? Because that's what they're supposed to do.
Well, no, I get that. But like at certain times, Steve, like one of my favorite moments is Booger, like there'll be a situation, like it's 3rd and 3. And Booger will say, all right, 3rd and 3, it's a big play here. They could either run or pass. Like those kind of things are like the things that you don't like.
Here's my problem. The Booger McFarland stuff that I see on social media gets completely out of control.
Mm-hmm.
He makes mistakes here and there. He's still a young broadcaster. But him being obvious, if that's a cardinal sin, then blow out most of the guys who do NFL football. Do you watch and listen to what Troy Aikman says during a game?
Yeah, 100%. Like they all have
nothing.
Their flaws.
Yep. Nothing. So why is Booger McFarland getting a rash of crap and Troy Aikman isn't?
Well, one, because he's on primetime. And Troy is on primetime to a certain extent, but it's not to the level that Monday Night Football is, right? A standalone game, the only game of the day. That's why he draws so much attention. But here's my thing, too, with this, in terms of the potential change. Having said all of this, which I can understand the complaints about McFarland and everything like that, ESPN would be stupid to get rid of him. Because what is you kind of alluded to it. Every single Monday night, what's trending on social media? It's Monday Night Football, it's Booger McFarland, it's ESPN, like to a certain extent. Like, their ratings were up on Monday Night Football this year. How much you want to bet some of that is watching the train, like the potential train wreck that is your announcer crew? It's a gold mine. You have to keep them.
Yeah, these two guys are cheese balls, but you're just going to replace them with more cheese balls. And
yeah.
They're probably going to try to go young again with, you know, the broadcaster. That person's not going to be ready. They're going to make lots of mistakes.
Well, you know who the potential replacement is.
Let Booger grow into the role. And I mean, listen, here's what's this is the other thing that's happening is that Tony Romo is so much better than almost every analyst in football history that everyone's measured against him. He's one of a kind.
Well,
that's it.
But that's also what makes this interesting, though, because just like Tom Brady, Tony Romo's a free agent, my friend. After this season's over, Tony Romo gets his pick of the litter. And the thought is that his new home would be ESPN.
This next year or the year after?
That would be 2020, if I read correctly.
Well, if they're replacing Booger with Romo immediately, then yeah, I can buy into that. But if they're just going to have another bridge to make a run at Romo, what's the point?
I'd be down with Joe, Booger, and Romo. Get the cart back, but put
Romo's
Romo
got
in
too
the
much.
Cart. But put Romo
no,
in the
no, cart. No, don't put Booger back in the cart.
That's no. Booger stays up there.
Put Joe in the cart.
No, Romo goes in the cart.
put Tassador in the cart. Most odd play-by-play vantage point we've ever seen in Monday Night Football history. All right, on the way back, we'll get to that Mike McCarthy presser. It was weird, but it was to be expected. It was about Jerry, and more Jerry.
The Big 5 at 4. Brought to you by Battleborn Injury Lawyers.
You're listening to Cofield and Company on ESPN Las Vegas.
John Von Tobel's in as company Cofield on a Wednesday. John, what was your reaction to the Cowboys hiring Mike McCarthy? Is he going to win down there?
He's Jason Garrett on, like, from a coaching perspective, he's Jason Garrett on steroids. Like, instead of going 8-8, he'll go 10-6 and go, you know, lose in the first round. I kind of like what we just talked about. I don't understand how we forget how much of a buffoon he was game management-wise for Green Bay. To the point
we don't. Lots of people haven't, and a lot of people address that or, you know, pointed it out. And then I guess the response was, well, in the year off, maybe he had the come-to-Jesus moment, and he's learned a lot more about analytics and being innovative.
I guess, perhaps. But also, and look, Aaron Rodgers has not proven to be the most, you know, he's not able to really be the most symbiotic partner, I guess you could say, you know, as a head to a head coach. We saw it early in the year with the whole audible thing with LaFleur. But at the same time, like, he drove a wedge between him and Rodgers because of his buffoonishness as a head coach. Like, that's a worrisome sign to me, too. Like, Rodgers, it seemed like, routinely thought he was an idiot. Although I feel like he thinks a lot of people are stupid.
So if you're hoping that Mike McCarthy would become more progressive, you know, feel like a more, a younger coach who was advancing, improving year to year, what do you think of the staff so far that they've put together? The defensive coordinator is Mike Nolan. And again, I don't want to sound like an ageist here, but he's 60. Joe Philbin will be on the staff. He'll be the O-line coach. Remember him?
Yep.
Former Dolphins coach. Pretty much the opposite of what we saw today with Matt Rhule. Like, not inspiring at all, but he's going to coach the O-line. But he's got a good track record and reputation as an assistant. John Fossil, forever with the Rams, is going to be the special teams coach now with the Cowboys. And on the defensive line, they are going to bring in Jim Tom Sula.
Has he been in football?
Yeah, he was the Redskins D-line coach.
Oh,
recently,
boy. That's great.
Year.
I love Jim.
So he changes addresses in the NFC East. But, yes, Jim Tom Sula and his uncontrollable farting is now part. Which, he better curb the freaking gas during those meetings with Jerry Jones.
That's right.
He can't be farting just uncontrollably around Jerry Jones.
That, and you got to learn how to speak, Jim. You know, the whole, that's not going to work. To be honest with you, you know me. I'm actually mildly ageist. That's the first thing that stuck out to me. Like,
I'm mildly ageist.
It's like John Fossil is the youngest dude at like 45, you know?
Right.
And I don't know if this is troublesome or not, but like, kind of a common thing amongst these guys is failed head coaches too, right? Yeah. So it's like, you know, how many does it take to change a light bulb kind of a deal? Like, is it good that they were all head coaches, or is it bad that they all failed as head coaches? So that's kind of, well, I mean.
Mike Nolan will dress in spiffy fashion. Wasn't he the guy who wore the suit all the time with the Niners?
It was him and Del Rio. Him and Del Rio actually get, like, permission to wear the suits, if I remember correctly? Like, bro, relax, okay? I feel like that's, like, P.J. Fleck would be the next guy. If Fleck ever comes up to the National Football League, he'll totally be suit guy.
Can I still wear my Letterman sweater during the NFL coaching on the sidelines? Can I do that?
Stupid vest sweater thing with the button down underneath.
But I knew that, because the Tom Sula thing really hasn't hit much, but that Tom Sula is probably going to be the defensive line coach. I knew that would be a big hit.
As long as he's associate head coach. Have we decided who associate head coach is? It's clearly got to be Jim Tom Sula. There's no other option.
Awesome. All right. Well, on the way back, we got to get to a little more on the Rooney Rule, more opinions on how there's been a lack of diversity with these coaching hires, including from our national morning show, Golic and Wingo.
Finley Toyota. They'll do anything to sell you a car. No Toyota problem is too tough, too large, or too small. Keep your Toyota running like a Toyota. You're listening to Cofield and Company on ESPN Las Vegas.
Well, lots of reaction to these NFL coaching hires over the last few days. Brown's still looking for someone. Matt Rhule is the coach in Carolina. We heard from him earlier on the show. Very inspirational, sermon-like press conference. Joe Judge, the Giants coach, will have his official press conference tomorrow. Mike McCarthy's was today. He really didn't get to speak much. Answered some questions, and Jerry Jones spoke for about 15 minutes. Very typical. Just saw a tweet from one of our buddies, John, Dustin Swettelson, who works for SiriusXM. He's a Giants fan. Giants fans are not happy right now, that especially since many of them got geeked up today about Rhule's press conference. He says, as a Giants fan, listening to Matt Rhule's press conference is like if I had to watch my ex-girlfriend's wedding video. Not bad.
I guess.
Not bad.
Why are you watching?
They're very heartbroken. They're very heartbroken. The Rhule came out hitting bombs today. You know, he's a New York area guy. They could have had him, but they chose to go cheap. Well, I'm not going to say Joe Judge is the cheap option, but they chose not to match what Matt Rhule got from the Panthers. So,
yeah. At the end of the day, you just don't know what he's going to be. So I get right. that he seemed to be the top candidate, but at the same time, you know, there is something to saying, like, look, like you seem like you're going to be a good candidate, but you're also an unknown, and we don't want to back up the Brinks truck. And then, because it's a no-win situation, because in 3-4 years, when he looks like a complete moron, if he does, then it's, look, it, you paid all this money for this guy. And just let it play out. I wouldn't be that heartbroken.
I'm going to set some odds here, but I get two coaches. Yes, minus 200. Eric Bieniemy or Marvin Lewis gets the Browns job. Plus 150, it's a white.
Wow, I would make the white the favorite.
Yeah.
I think I mean,
really trying to give you a pretty easy bet there.
Yeah, and the thing would be, if you're actually going to differentiate between the two, I would think Bieniemy would probably be the favorite to do so, considering what he's done with Kansas City and the track record, and of course we know about the kid that he's working with and the development there. So, but
actually, I'll throw in Jim Caldwell too, who absolutely should be in the running after winning in freaking Detroit, where Matt Patricia has grinded the whole thing to a halt. Which I was wrong on. I thought Matt Patricia was going to be an upgrade. He's not, but I don't know that we're going to see Eric Bieniemy, the hot prospect, who, by the way, basically, from what we know, does the same thing that Matt Nagy did in Kansas City, and Nagy was the hot candidate a couple years ago when he got the Bears job, because we know Andy Reid does much of the play calling, but Bieniemy hasn't gotten a job yet. So I don't think it's going to be the young guy in Bieniemy, and I don't think they're going to go the older guy route. I actually think they should go the older guy route in Caldwell or Marvin Lewis or name whoever else you want to run the Browns, but I don't think any of those three guys will get the job.
So this is kind of what, and you've kind of brought this up in passing, and you've talked about this before, and I think there's a lot of troubling stuff that's coming out of this whole thing with the Rooney Rule, right? Like, the Rooney Rule is a toothless rule. It's insulting to a certain extent, too, when you just call guys in for 10 minutes so you can fill out the requirement and then move on to hire the guy that you want. But at the same time, so there's that issue. The issue separate from that is something that you have brought up, which is, for some reason, minority head coaches, African-American head coaches, their quote-unquote failings somehow stick with them longer or perhaps forever than white coaches. Mike McCarthy is a perfect example of a general thought, at least the content that I took in was that it was a positive to hire Mike McCarthy. When the last time I remember Mike McCarthy, he was a fumbling fool, and I was actually sent a DM on Twitter, right, of another tweet. Remember back in, I think, 2013 when he tried to challenge a play that was automatically reviewed, thus losing a timeout. Like, the guy was kind of stupid, right? Yeah. But we forget about that. But then you have, like, a Jim Caldwell, for example, who did a great job in Detroit, who actually took the Colts to a Super Bowl. That year they went 14-2. His final year there, they got decimated with injuries. You know what happened with Peyton Manning and all that. He was awesome in Detroit. But you actually have reactions of, what has Jim Caldwell ever done? What has Jim Caldwell ever done? Like, he went to the playoffs with Detroit and had 2 9-7 seasons. And he scoffed at it. And I think that's also part of this troubling deal. Like, for some reason, when it comes to that sort of thing, minority coaches, and Jim Caldwell's a perfect example, despite the fact that he had a winning record in a place like Detroit where nobody can, he is viewed somehow as a failure. Or Marvin Lewis, where you have Redskins fans laughing at the thought of having a Marvin Lewis as their head coach when their team has been absolute dreck for a very long time. And I would think that they would ask to go to the playoffs for 7 years and have a few 10 and 11 win seasons. And yeah, you'll lose in the first round, but at least you're competitive. And I find that equally troubling as this Rooney Rule that does nothing for minority and African-American head coaches in a sport that's predominantly black, too. Like, guess that's the other thing. Stop doing this whole thing where it's like, well, if you look at the population numbers, it's actually percentage-wise the exact same. No, it's not the same. The NFL and football in general is an entirely different population than the one that you live in the entire world. And that's why it's also troubling that it's so disproportionate.
Yeah. NBA doesn't have the issue, right?
Well, they do to a certain extent as well, but it's not as bad.
It's better.
Yeah.
It's better. Mike Olick was onto something this morning because, you know, people are like, hey, all the owners, bunch of old, rich, white guys. How about the coaches? In the end, aren't they the ones who get final say, many of them? Unless you're, you know, working for an organization like Jerry Jones and the Cowboys where, you know, he's picking the guys. But what about the coaches? Can't they make changes? Because really, the problem with boosting guys up to head coach is that you don't have many coordinators who are African-American. Here's Mike Golick this morning.
Ownership certainly deserves some of the blame in this. Without question, they deserve that. But there would be a lot more candidates in the pipeline for this if the coaches were hiring them to be coordinators.
Okay. Plain and simple. Yeah. I pretty much gave you the whole quote.
Exactly.
I mean, that one's obvious, and we really didn't harp on that much yesterday when we talked about it. You know, if we're going to point a finger at the owners as, you know, old guys who are only comfortable with their own type, what's wrong with the coaches?
Yep.
They coach African-Americans. They have black dudes on their staffs. Why don't they boost them to OC and DC more often?
Yeah.
Why did Bruce Arians essentially have to make a statement by doing so last year to show the rest of the league, like, what's wrong with you guys?
No, 100%. Like, the issues all trickle down. And, you know, and I think it was a Sports Illustrated piece that I was reading. It even points out, too, like, to a certain extent, part of the issue that's coming around is, like, the new craze has been these offensive coaches. And, by the way, speaking of coaches who can, like, fail upwards, again, like Cliff Kingsbury in Arizona, maybe he's going to do a great job, but he went from being fired at Texas Tech to a head coach of an NFL team. Like, find me an African-American or minority coach who's going to be able to do that. I doubt that you will be able to. But the part of the thing, too, that was pointed out is it's this big trend that you want to have a spread out and an up-tempo and good offense and this dynamic passing attack, yada, yada, yada. And offensive coaches tend to be white, and that's also part of it. We have this trend in the NFL that you want to have a good offense, thus you're going to hire offensive guys, but all your offensive coordinators are predominantly white, and that's also a problem, speaking to what Golic is talking about.
Yeah, I was going to say they're also predominantly former quarterbacks,
yep,
who for years and years and years have been, you know, mostly white as well. Not ripping these guys, but you saw there are two UNLV, former UNLV quarterbacks. One moved and the other was retained, but Shane Steichen is going to continue as the OC in LA with the Chargers, and Scott Turner just moved from the Panthers. He's Norv Turner's son. He was on UNLV's football team years ago. Scott Turner is going to be the OC in Washington with Ron Rivera.
Mm-hmm.
So you're seeing mostly quarterbacks get a chance to be offensive coordinator. We had an offensive lineman on yesterday, Willie Anderson, who played in the league, and he was saying, why aren't more offensive line coaches bumped to be the offensive coordinator? Why does it have to be just quarterbacks?
Yep. No, it's absolutely right, and it's just this weird thing that they have. And maybe, you know, in a few years, 10, 20 years, right, because we've talked about this before, as quarterbacks now in the National Football League that are playing are becoming more and more diverse, and you're having guys like Patrick Mahomes, who's at the absolute top of his game, Lamar Jackson, who looks like he's going to be a very good quarterback for the next 10 years, Russell Wilson, we know who he is, and, you know, maybe this is going to be start to become more of a norm, and that eventually in, you know, 20 years, you'll have more minority and more diversity amongst these coordinators. But there's also been talk of, and this is a great point too, like Richard Sherman talked about it, he doesn't see it changing, but some of these African-American coaches are saying, screw this, I'm going to college. And that's also been part of this, is you've kind of seen this exodus from the NFL of some of these African-American and minority coaches are going, you know what, I'm just going to coach in college. There's more teams, there's more opportunities, there's more of a chance that I can latch on. And then maybe in 5-10 years, once I've worked my way through the ranks of college, I can work my way up to the NFL.
On the way back, we'll take a look at some numbers for tonight's games around the Mountain West Conference, and also a big change on Twitter. I wonder how that's going to affect gambling Twitter.
Join the conversation on Twitter at Cofield & Co.
It's Cofield & Company's Eye on Sports Gambling.
I'm going to kill your bookmaker. I'm going to rip his throat out. I will step on his throat until the man chokes. Let me tell you how. Winners, 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 winners. Free, 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 free.
All right, John. Let's look around the NBA. We'll get to some college numbers here and then a big change on Twitter, maybe. First of all, any thoughts on what we got coming up in about 15 minutes? New Orleans and Chicago. Pelicans are for Zion Williamson on the horizon or not? What's the timetable?
Yeah, it sounds like he's actually really close. Let me pull this up in this report that I was reading the other day. Because I think it might be within the next 2 weeks that we could be seeing him back on the floor here. Like, they're taking their sweet time, but it's on the horizon. As far as tonight, I didn't have anything of this game. Chicago, surprisingly, is actually a top 10 team in terms of defensive efficiency. Their offense is just what really struggles. New Orleans has been playing much better basketball as of late. They did lose the other night, controversial call against the Jazz. There was a non-call and a foul. I think it was Ingram who went up for a hoop, ultimately didn't get it. But before that, they had won 5 out of 6. They had been playing very well. They've been covering numbers. So I can understand why you would like New Orleans, considering the form that they've been. And you're laying a cheap number. It's right now it's 3.5, but it looks like it's moving to 4 because there's a couple fours popping right now, and it opened up at 4.
Okay. How about this score from an earlier game? Boston 7 against San Antonio. Celtics are down 21. 52-31. San Antonio, 6 minutes left in the first half. Am I wrong, but are the Spurs starting to come on?
They are. So coming into today, they were 5-5 straight up in their last 10 games, but they had covered 7 of those. So they've just been playing better. And the interesting note that I was looking through the numbers yesterday for the show. So on the season, the Spurs are dead last in terms of three-point attempts per game. They're right around 27, like 20, 26.8, 27 flat. But during this 10-game stretch, they've taken 32 three-point attempts per game. So they're kind of steering more into, hey, let's start playing basketball like it's 2020, and we'll start taking three-point shots. LaMarcus, stop taking these insanely long mid-range shots, take a step back and start shooting threes, and it's made a big difference. And I think that's been the difference for them. The question is, are they going to stick to it? But I'm trying to look it up. Did Kemba Walker end up playing? Because it's loading right now. That was a big injury question mark. Yeah, he did. Yeah, Kemba Walker's on the floor playing 12 minutes up to this point. Him and Tice were the injury question. So looks like just a flat spot right now for Boston.
Late spot, Bucks off a weird loss against San Antonio by 22, yeah. And now they're laying 13.5 at Golden State.
I love watching Golden State basketball only because of how bad it is. and they had that spurt right around Christmas where they're actually winning games and covering, but this is all about what kind of mindset Milwaukee's in at this point. And coming off of a loss, I wouldn't want to get in front of Milwaukee against a team like Golden State, who is plucky in first quarters and possibly in first halves, but if you're talking about the entire game, you know, they fight, but they're not suited to take on a team like Milwaukee.
Golden State at home, 6-12. On the road, 3-17.
Yeah.
So much better. Chase, much better.
Gives I like it. I've watched a disgusting amount of Warriors basketball. I don't know why.
Well, it's usually the last game of the night, and you're about to go do your show on VSiN on Channel 204, so why not, right?
That's a good point.
Yeah. What's going on? Uh-oh. We have random sound popping up.
Ari's freaking out.
It always happens, John, with the old guy. It always happens.
Ari's freaking out. I thought it was him.
Yeah. Mountain West Conference tonight. Rebels are getting 6 against Boise. Early thoughts?
I'd rather take the points at that. You know, when I was going over some of the stuff, getting ready for the show today, the one thing that sticks out to you with Boise is, and this is obviously regardless of what UNLV's been doing, which you can get into, they're awful inside. Opponents are shooting 70% at the rim. They are in the near 300s in terms of rim defense at this point. Excuse me, in terms of two-point percentage defensively. Let's see. 301st in opponent two-point percentage. So the interior is extremely soft. Like, they have some size, but it's not like girth size. It's just like length. And UNLV, during this win streak, they have been great inside. They've been drawing free throws. We know how they have a whole bunch of guys who like to get to the rim. During this four-game win streak, they're only shooting like 27% from three. This is all going to be about, can you just attack Boise inside? And I think defensively, Boise can be had there. So I think I'd rather take points with UNLV than lay them with Boise State up to this point.
Yeah, Leon Rice has a team now that he used to have some reliable bigs, you know, guys who are 6'10", 6'11", who could at least eat space. And now he's got mostly guards and small forwards. Robin George plays a little bit. He's the lone big at, you know, 6'11 and around 250, but it's mostly long, lengthy guys, as you mentioned. Derek Alston's awesome. They just got Abu Kijab eligible. He's around 6'6". Alston's, you know, long, but he's thin at 6'8", 6'9". R.J. Williams is only about 6'6". Hobbs comes off the bench a little bit thicker, but he's around 6'5". So there should be opportunities inside. Rebels just have to hope that Boise doesn't go crazy from three, and Boise is. This is kind of a buzzsaw spot. Boise is going to be fired up. They're coming off a 17-point loss on the road where they got blitzed down the stretch against Nevada. And to your point about, you know, them being weak on two-pointers, Reno took advantage of the Boise defense by bombing from deep, and I just don't think the Rebels are going to be firing up a 14 of 29 performance like Reno just did from long range.
Well, I mean, if the numbers play out like we've seen up to this point, neither team is actually a really skilled three-point shooting team. Boise only has Jessup as like their main threat in terms of three-point shooting, and he takes 60% of his shots from deep. But you look at the other guys, like Austin, 36%. He's attempted 103 threes so far, so that's solid. But like Marcus Dickinson's 36%. He's only taken 41 shots. You know, their next guy has taken 20 three-point attempts. So they're not exactly the best three-point shooting team either. So I'll be interested to see where it is from a scoring perspective, like just the game overall.
Trap spot tonight for San Diego State, unbeaten San Diego State, number 7 in the country, on the road at Wyoming. The problem is it's Wyoming in the trap spot. Wyoming's getting 16 on the way for San Diego State is Boise next. I think they've got Reno in the offing and also at Fresno State. And then Reno is at San Jose State. This is an interesting one. Again, San Jose State can be a trap spot oftentimes. They have played better this year, and they've had some big performances. Richard Washington with 25 in a game recently, and that was the win over New Mexico. So we'll see what Reno has tonight as they're laying 9.5 on the road in what will be a very empty, very quiet San Jose State arena.
Yeah, San Jose State has actually been pretty good against the number, and a lot of it has to do with a team. Like, you kind of see this with teams that have been awful historically, and they're just a little bit better this year because they have some roster continuity. They're 7-8 against the number on the season. A lot of it is big numbers, a lot just being really undervalued. So I would agree, like, they've been a tricky spot for a lot of teams. Now, like a couple of weeks ago when they were taking on, I think, was it San Jose State that they were taking on, and they were really plucky? Or, excuse me, Utah State. Doesn't look as great now, but San Jose State's been a good team to back in certain spots this year.
Yep. All right, we got changes on Twitter, and the first thing I thought of was gambling Twitter. Let's see if these changes could affect gambling Twitter. What are the changes?
So apparently Twitter's going to be coming out with an update, and you can – and I'm trying to pull up the exact terms, but essentially what you can do is you can limit – who interacts with your tweet, and they have certain terms for it. So, like, for example, the one I do remember, a statement is a tweet that you can send out that has the responses shut off and that nobody can respond to them whatsoever. And then you have others where it's only people that you follow or tweet or people in the tweet can respond to, and then there's, like, a global or an open one where anybody that can see the tweet can respond to it. Now, obviously, nobody in their right mind anymore, especially if they have something mildly controversial, is going to select the global option. And I wonder if that's, like, somewhat dangerous. Like, part of it's annoying in terms of, right, like, the littlest thing and people jumping all over it, but it does serve to police people who are overly bigoted or racist to a certain extent. And if you turn off that kind of response, I think that's somewhat dangerous in the grand scheme.
I wonder when people tweet out stuff like that if ultimately they want response, good and bad, so why would they turn it off?
Yeah.
Now, I think where it's dangerous for gambling Twitter, because now if you have the opportunity to exist in an echo chamber and never be called on things, that could be a problem. We have noticed that Jason McIntyre of FS1 has struggled a bit now that he's a gambling expert. I wonder how he'll look at this, because he's been getting a rash of crap. He got a rash of crap for the whole football season.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, things like that is also, on a smaller scale, it is dangerous, because there is no one to stop you from going, I am, 79%, here, and here, and nobody.
Or just changing your picks or changing your record.
Exactly, because the dangerous part of what you're talking about too is, let's say somebody changes their record, right? And we saw this with McIntyre a month ago, where they posted a video. His record had been altered from previous videos to look better.
Yeah.
Immediately, almost every single response on the video was, "Your record's wrong. It's this. What are you doing?" He responds with, "Oh, sorry, there was a mistake. We'll fix it." And they eventually fixed it. But in certain, I don't know if he was being, if he was trying to be something, he's doing something wrong, or he was trying to pull one over on people. I don't know what the intent was. But in situations like that where somebody has the intent to deceive, that's where it's dangerous, because somebody's going to come along and go, "Wow, this guy's pretty good. Let me invest my money in some of these picks, blah, blah, blah." And then you go from there.
Can I give you a little heads up for the audience? I think I heard this correctly earlier in the day over on our sister station, Fox Sports Las Vegas. I'm not sure if this was a national spot, local. I don't think it was local, but I'm not exactly sure. Tim Donaghy is now selling picks, the former NBA referee.
Oh, he's big.
I swear he did a pitch today for a free phone call with three picks and said he's 28-1 in the NBA recently. Documented. Awesome. If you hear someone say they're 28-1, come on.
I mean, people fall for it, though.
That's just how do people fall for that? It's not even possible.
Steve, like, I can't. You can. I don't even have to name names. You know, people buy stuff like that all the time. They do. Because here's the bottom line. Period. You just shouldn't buy picks, right? It's like this vicious cycle of whole thing. Like, if somebody's selling picks, right? Why do they need? If they're a professional gambler, like they say, why are they selling picks? Because they don't need the monetary income if they're a professional gambler, like they tell you. If they do have an edge that they tell you that they have, well, then you're not getting the best number, because immediately when that person makes that bet or makes that play or sends it out, the number's going to move, and you're not going to get the best number. So there's just don't buy
picks.
We
should also say that any professional gambler who is making big money would never want to put out their record and ruin their opportunity to continue to get their bets down.
Of course. It's all about beating the market. You don't want to go and tell the market, hey, I'm kicking your ass.
So, yes, beware of the Tim Donaghy's of the world. All right, we get an early start to the 5 o'clock hour. We're going to talk to Mike Romala, get you ready for this game. UNLV is at Boise State, and John Von Tobel is going to take you right up until Runnin' Rebel warm-up. John and Curtis are on shortly after 5:30.
Visit Cofield's Corner on LVSportsNetwork.com for access to the latest podcasts and best interviews. From the Finley Toyota Studio, it's Cofield and Company.
Hey, babe, I made you a bitchin' mixtape.
So you must really be mad. And for what?
You know, keep working. Hard work pays off, you know what I'm saying?
It's time for Cofield and Company with Steve Cofield on ESPN Las Vegas.
Back here in the 5 o'clock hour in Boise, it's Steve Cofield as we're getting ready for the 6 o'clock tip. UNLV on the road against Boise State at Extra Mile Arena, no longer Taco Bell Arena. Mike Romala is on the road as well for the Las Vegas Sun. So let's get into the UNLV side first. First news off the court, another recruit, another commit. Who is he?
He is a did I forget his name already? No, he's a
Devin Tillis.
Yeah, Devin Tillis. He's a unranked, unrecruited wing player from Los Angeles, 6'6", the seventh guy to commit. The strange thing is you look him up. I was trying to find info about him, and just there's really not anything out there. You know, no offers from Division I schools. All of his offers were from, you know, Division II. There's just not much on him. Unranked, no stars. Like, if you want, like, the 3- or 4-star recruits, he's not that. He's just a kid that they, I guess, impress the coaching staff enough to think they think that he's going to develop into something. But yeah, not a whole lot out there about Devin Tillis right now.
Well, it's interesting. This is a sort of a trust in TJ and staff, you know, recruiting class to this point. There's some elite recruits there. There's some good 3-stars. There's guys bordering on 4-star rankings. But there are a couple of players, including a JUCO, where when they committed, we were all like, whoa, who is this? But the point is, now they've got, what, is it officially 7 in the fold?
Yeah, they've got 6 guys who actually are signed already for 2020, and Tillis is the 7th guy. He's just committed. He hasn't signed yet. There's also, I've heard some talk that he might be a prep school for a year,
right,
and he may actually be part of the 2021 class. But for now, they've got 7 guys in 2020, which is a huge number, obviously. That's more than half of your roster being turned over. And especially, it would be one thing if you had, you know, a large class of seniors, you know, graduating and set to move out, but they really don't. They've got 3 guys who are on track to graduate. 4, maybe, if you count Donnie Tillman, who's looking to go pro. So that's like 4 guys on the way out. You still got to sweep out a bunch of guys in order to make room for this class. So, and they just keep recruiting. They just keep adding to it. I remember being sort of a raised an eyebrow when they added the 5th guy, and when they added the 6th, you're like, whoa. And now that they're at 7, it's clear what TJ thinks of this current team.
Yeah, I think there's going to be some redshirt candidates in the group of 7 that have committed. My guess is that they add at least 1 or 2 more players, so they could be pushing the number to 9. And also clear, he meant business when he was talking about 2 weeks ago when he got really frustrated around the Pacific game and, you know, threw it out there. Hey, you know, we're going to play a certain style of basketball. You're going to have to do certain things off the floor. And if you don't want to do that, we're going to find new players. So I think everyone right now is aware of the situation they're playing for their roster spot next year.
And it's one thing for a coach to say that, that he, you know, if you don't play the way I want to play, you know, you'll be out of here, and we'll bring in someone who does want to play. It sounds good as a threat, but has T.J. Otzelberger struck you as like an empty threat kind of guy so far?
No,
not really. He seems like the exact opposite.
Well,
like,
guys aren't playing. Veteran players for a while didn't play. They got their minutes cut down. If they don't play well, they're going to sit. Right. You know, Bryce Hamilton's been spectacular at times, but at times he's had his minutes limited. I mean, we'll get to Donnie Tillman and his status for tonight in a couple of minutes, but you know, I think that would shock a lot of people that your second or third best player doesn't play at all. Wow. Oh, averaging 11 points a game. So let's talk about what he tried to establish a couple of weeks ago, and that was taking guys out of the starting lineup and going with, as you guys are calling them, the try-hard guys. What do you think of the results so far, not only from the try-hard guys specifically, like Jay Green and Marvin Coleman, but the effect it's had on the team?
They're bought in at this point. The results help. You know, winning four in a row helps the players to buy in. Winning without Donnie Tillman in the last game against Air Force helps the buy in. When you can tell a guy like that, hey, we'll win without you playing this way, and then you go out and do it, he really has no choice now. It's 100% on Tillman now. T.J. Otzelberger has all the leverage in that relationship now. Tillman's got to straighten up and be on time to everything, or they're going to leave him behind. So everyone is buying in. You feel it, and everybody's in a good mood at practice and the post game. There's just a different vibe about the team when everybody's committed like this. So I mean, it worked more. It's not so much, you know, try hard. It's the changing the identity of the team from guys who want to score and put up a bunch of points, and turning those guys into getting them to understand like the only way they're going to win is by playing hard defense. That's not an easy thing to do. For one or two guys, it's extremely difficult to get an entire team to just flip the switch like that in the middle of the season. So I give credit to Otzelberger for that, at least. Like, they've completely flipped their identity from with the kind of team we thought they were going to be at the beginning of the year.
Have you talked to Tillman or any of the coaches on the staff about Tillman and the tardiness? It's pretty insane.
It's off, not on the record, but just there's definitely been some frustration there all season. Like, obviously, this is the third incident. This isn't a new thing. It's been something since the beginning. You know, they recruited him thinking he was going to be a big part of this team. And on the court, he sort of fades in and fades out. Good games, bad games, sort of floats. You're not exactly sure what you're going to get from him. Off the court, you know, just the continued incidents. You know, he's giving you the stereotypical one foot in, one foot out kind of commitment to this point in the season. And that's what he, like, he's a guy who went through the draft process last year. We've been hearing all along that he wants to go pro after this year. He seems like the one guy who's not really bought into this current UNLV team. He might not want to be Marvin Coleman is completely willing to play defense as hard as he can for 35 minutes a night, even if it means scoring no points. Coleman is willing to do that. Is Donnie Tillman willing to do that? It's like, so far he hasn't been. So that's what you're waiting for. Will the light go on for him at some point? Because that would be very big for the team, but so far it hasn't.
And I'll tell you a little story about meaning what they're saying about being on time. So as part of the UNLV broadcast team, we travel with the team. We travel on the plane. So you'll meet up, you know, bus trip over to the airport. The bus trip yesterday was supposed to launch at noon. I get there early. You know, I'm not always the most on-time guy, but I've kind of learned the lesson, and I looked down at my watch, 11:50, we were rolling right out onto the airport. So if you're late, especially if you're not earlier than on time, you may miss the boat.
Yeah, and that's, like we said, it's not really an idle threat. Like, if T.J. Otzelberger says, we'll leave you behind and you'll have to take a cab, he probably means it. Like, you're probably going to have to take a cab to the airport.
And that wasn't Otz with the bus departure time. That was Tim Buckley, so it goes up and down the staff. So let's talk about, I don't know if you were around when they were giving out the awards the other day. So then, now they've got an efficiency chain, which is really cool, a stopper belt, and a hustle robe. The winners were what? Marvin Coleman, Mbakay Jong, and Amari Hardy.
Yes. Now, the stopper belt, they introduced that before the season. And I asked about it about a month into the season, and Otzelberger said, you know, it's not really the right time to give it up because they weren't really playing well. And, you know, I guess he didn't want to send a message like give out awards when the teams, you know, win one, lose one. Right. So they held off on that, and they gave it up for the first time. And Mbakay Jong is a good choice for that. The efficiency chain, I'm interested in because how do they measure that? I know that I was doing some of my own calculations, and Marvin Coleman, the last four games during the winning streak, has just been great with the plus minus. Like, whenever he's on the floor, they beat the other team. So that may be one component of it.
Mike, does anyone use the plus minus anymore? Aside from you. You love it.
I love it not so much individually. I love it, the five-man lineups and everything. Right. The combinations. College basketball, the season's really too short to really get anything great from plus-minus. But I like the lineups. And pretty much every lineup that Marvin Coleman is in just outperforms the opponent when they're on the floor together.
We're getting ready for a 6 o'clock tip. Boise hosting the Running Rebels. Mike Romalo's on the road here at Steve Cofield as we're both in Boise. So I want to get to Boise in about 5 minutes, but you said you wrote about Marvin Coleman. You've been kind of watching what he's doing. You understand why he's playing so hard. Did you get anything else interesting out of the story with Marvin Coleman?
It's just, I find it interesting that this time last year he was a walk-on who was not playing, and now you fast forward 1 year, he's on scholarship, and he's all of a sudden just the leader of the team. Like, if I asked you, who is the unchallenged leader of the team? It's Coleman, right?
I'd say Coleman. I'd say still Hardy. I think Hardy's turned things around. And I talked to Coleman last week, and I asked him about being a leader at this age, and he's like, age doesn't matter. Because, I mean, I think a great example is he's a walk-on. He's a former walk-on. He's a sophomore. Bryce Hamilton is a sophomore. Bryce Hamilton was a, you know, 3-borderline 4-star guy, and yet Marvin has emerged as a leader, and we're still kind of looking for those extra intangibles out of Bryce Hamilton.
Exactly. That's a great comparison between those two guys. It's like, when Marvin Coleman has something to say, you get the feeling that the rest of the guys listen and they feed off of it, whereas Bryce is not really that kind of personality. He's more, you know, introverted or a little more quiet. Coleman, it's just been sort of fascinating how quickly the team has responded to him. And even the coaching staff, like Otzelberger said, he said, you know, when the season started and when I gave him the scholarship in the offseason, you know, I didn't see it in him. I didn't understand, like, his game.
Wow.
Because he's just looking at him on the floor and in practice and the numbers, and he didn't get it. But then once he started playing, and once Mitchell Long went out, and Coleman's got to play more and more, and you see the way the team responds, and you outscore the opponent every time he's on the floor, and you see the way he pumps up his teammates and gets them playing hard, now Otzelberger says, you know, now I see his value. Now I understand, like, why he's important to our team. If you asked me, you know, 3 weeks ago, you know, who's gonna go to make room for these scholarship guys next year, seven incoming players, Coleman would have been on that list of guys who are gone.
Yep, not anymore.
No way. And now they'll be welcoming back with open arms.
Yeah, Marvin played 33 minutes in the first 9 games combined, and he was out there for 36. Marvin Coleman was in the last game. And it also, you know what, it's a reminder to media, it's a reminder to fans that the season comes in pieces, and it's a very inexact science. Even the coaches don't recognize at times who their real valuable players are. I mean, you go back to last year, it was almost the same exact story until they went down to Hawaii and they got a little thin. Nick Blair hadn't played at all. And then all of a sudden, Nick Blair's out there playing in key spots. And actually, last year, the game up here at Boise, Nick Blair was gigantic. He had 3 threes in the game. And he's one of those try-hard guys with the numbers as well. So I mentioned Hardy as a leader. I still think he's respected. What do you think Amari went through for a couple of weeks there, and how do you think he's come out of it? Last game, he had 21 points on just 11 shots from the floor.
He's the guy who's had to go through a lot of stylistic changes, and he's the guy who's had to maybe take coaching more than anyone else on the team just because of the fit. Like, we know how he likes to play, and we know how Otzelberger wants the team to run, and those two things are sort of like the opposite of each other. So Hardy's had to get it. They had to drill it into him. I don't know if he's completely there yet. Part of it, I think, that's helped him is that Coleman's emergence, because Coleman can take him off the ball a little bit, let him be more of the scorer. The ball moves a little bit more freely now. But, that's quite an accomplishment for Amari Hardy to now he's wearing that hustle robe, which I guess shows how much the coaches appreciate, you know, the way he's working for it. This is a guy who was pulled from the starting lineup a few games ago, and now he's, you know, playing well and scoring and picking his spots maybe a little bit better.
X factor, at least in this block of the season, as they try to race out to a really good record in the Mountain West Conference, is it too easy to say it's Bryce Hamilton?
It's only because we haven't seen it from him before in, like, any kind of sustained way. Like, he just had 2 great games in a row, and that's, I think, the first time he's had 2 good games in a row. Like, he's had 1 good game, and then, like, a few weeks later, he'll have another good game, scoring double figures, shoot 50% from the floor. But I don't even know if he's – I'd have to go back and look. Has he ever had 2 good games in a row even? This might be the first time, so I'm not expecting him to play like this for the rest of the year, because part of me doesn't really expect him to play like that tonight. Like,
part of it – I think part of the success with Bryce – is the way the team's working and the fact that the ball is moving more quickly and the defense is shifting. If it's slow ball movement and Bryce has to basically go one-on-one with a defender right in front of him to get to the 10, then that's not going to work. That's when he gets charges. But if the ball is moving quickly, as Otzelberger pointed out after the last game, there were openings because the ball was moving, and you know Bryce can take advantage of that. I thought the other thing he was impressive. Well, first of all, his best skill. I mean, this is where he's a high-level Division I basketball player is, and it's going to sound weird. Him crashing to the rim with a shot and then following up his own shot. I mean, you don't want to miss on purpose, but he's amazing at that. And I also thought he was really effective in the last game when he had a couple of openings on the baseline. If a defender is not guarding the baseline, really either side, because he can go left on someone. Especially if he's in the right corner, then he's going to get to the basket. And the other thing he's been great at is shedding contact and drawing fouls. He's a strong kid now.
Yeah, the thing that you mentioned that I think is maybe the most important is the fact that he's taking advantage of the defense when it's out of position with the ball movement, just because that's so central to everything that Otzelberger wants to do offensively. Like, the entire concept is quick ball movement, spread the floor, make the defense cover a lot of ground quickly so that when Hamilton catches it, you've got to train him at some point to just catch it and make that first move before the defense gets reset. You know, you've got to attack the gap. You don't want to attack a player. You want to attack a gap before the player gets set. And when he does that, you see, like, he's shooting 9 out of 10, 7 out of 9. Like, he can get to the basket and make those shots. So that's been probably the best sign for him. If this is the kind of player he can be from now on, because they need someone besides Hardy who can dribble the ball into the paint and score around the rim and draw fouls. So if he gives them that, you know, that would be huge, and that would be like that sort of X-factor player that you're talking about.
Yep. Donnie Tillman can too, but you got to show up on time. He's got to earn his playing time back. And the other guy who can do it is Elijah Mitru-Long. But right now he's hurt. Do we have any sort of update timetable on when he could return?
It's by the end of January, I think he said. Like, he's not that far away. But at the same time, like, Coleman's emergence has sort of mitigated that. Like, it was when Coleman went down, it looked like a death blow. It looked like, oh, what are they going to do? Like, they need this kid out there for almost 40 minutes. And that's what he was playing before he got hurt. He's playing almost the entire game. But Coleman has sort of played well enough and done a good enough job that, you know, they can hold off on Coleman. It's not, you know, the end of the world if it takes him a couple more weeks to get back. But he'll definitely help the depth and the guard rotation when he does come back.
And we should throw in Jonah Antonio. He's playing better. You know, he's not hitting the shots at the percentage he wants to right now, but he looks stronger out there. The hand doesn't look like it's debilitating. And keep in mind, the reason that – well, one of the reasons the Running Rebels won this game last year in Boise was that they shot lights out from three-point range, 14 of 26, so they could use some Jonah Antonio threes tonight. All right. The Boise side. First of all, this is it's an early start Vegas time. I don't know if everyone knows, but ESPN offered the 9 o'clock slot. That would be 9 o'clock local in Boise. Leon Rice turned it down. He chose the earlier start, went away from TV. What do you think of that?
I reading the local press, it's because they want more people in the arena. They're more concerned about getting people to the game and building like some sort of home court advantage. They're more concerned with that than they are with the TV ratings or getting that exposure.
Which I don't blame them, but I do think last year the attendance was horrific, and it was a late start.
Mm-hmm.
It was probably 1,500. I'm not sure that they're going to get more than 5,000 tonight, though. So I guess it'll be better than 1,500, but I wouldn't expect 8,000 or 9,000.
Shouldn't UNLV be a draw, like in the conference? That must be so tough. We don't...
Well, it's that big in Boise. Yeah, it sounds ridiculous. A couple of Vegas media guys talking about Boise's attendance when UNLV is way down, but I just don't think they've embraced it really outside of a few moments. I guess we'll see when some of the bigger opponents come in. But looking at the attendance so far, it hasn't been great for their home games. All right, who are the dangerous guys on the Boise side?
Alston. Derek Alston is the number one guy. The ball's going to be in his hands. He's a scorer, slasher. He can get to the rim. He's a really good player. Jessup is the three-point shooter, another really solid player. And then this Abu Kijab from Oregon, mm-hmm. transfer, midseason transfer. He has stepped in the last few games, and just immediately they've thrown him the ball. He's number two in usage since he's been activated. Scores 14, 15 points a game. Efficient guy, can shoot the three, can go inside. And all these guys are the same, you know, 6'6", 6'7".
Yeah, they're not
Alston,
necessarily
6'8".
A big team. RJ Williams comes off the bench. Sometimes he starts. He's a guy that they expected a lot from last year. And I think when UNLV came up here, he was still fighting the end results of mono. But he's had a pretty good year, especially on the boards. The other guy we mentioned, and he may not be the top guy on the scouting report, but he's really good in the mid-range. He's excellent with pick and roll on both ends of that, especially rolling and hitting the mid-range jumpers. Ooh, I know people don't like mid-range jumpers, but Alex Hobbs is a dangerous guy.
Yeah, we both like him. He's it's just we're like five or six players deep now, and all of these guys are like pretty good scorers. If you look, the, you know, statistically in the open court, they've got so many guys like transition wise, in terms of points per possession, the number 15 in the country. Like as a team, if you let their guards push the ball ahead, they'll pull up for three. They'll go all the way to the rim. They'll execute the two-on-one, the three-on-two. They'll get those corner threes in transition. That's probably the biggest focus for UNLV because there's just so many options. If you let Boise State beat you across half court, they're going to score. Get back on defense. You got to make them play in the half court, and you can maybe contain, you know, four scorers playing together if you get them in the half court.
And to me, this Boise team should be a top six team in the conference. I'm not sure what they are. I don't know. Kijab is relatively new to the roster. They got freaking romped on by Reno. How good is this team?
I don't know. It's
last year they stumbled to 13-20, but there was the interesting note in KenPom that they were one of the five unluckiest teams. They actually have analytics for that, that they were unlucky most of the year, and they just got, you know, they were on the wrong side of a lot of close losses.
I've got a theory that I've been kicking around for about Leon Rice for a couple of years now. And the theory goes that, you know, he's got a reputation as being, you know, one of the best, better coaches in the Mountain West because they always sort of outperformed their expectations. My theory is that he was an early adopter of that pace and space, spread the floor, shoot the three. And that's how they out-coached you, that because they were playing that more efficient style before it was really in vogue. And other teams are sort of caught up to that. If you look around the Mountain West, like five, six, 7 years ago, they were the only team doing it. Now, probably more than half the teams are doing it. It's probably just eliminated a little bit of that coaching advantage, that little bit of that style of play advantage, and now it's they're more on even ground, and you're not seeing them outperform expectations as much as usual. So you sort of you expect them to get that coach's bump, and they're just not getting it anymore.
All right, Mike, good job. Follow Mike from the Las Vegas Sun at Mike Grimala. JVT is coming back. John Von Tobel will take you around the conference and right up to running Rebel warm-up.
Stick around. Cofield and Company returns in minutes in the Finley Toyota Studios. Now, back to Cofield and Company on ESPN Las Vegas.
All right, great spot with Cofield. Again, live out in Boise. You're going to hear his wonderful voice again in about 4 minutes with Running Rebel warm-up. Sideline crew, that is Steve Cofield in and of himself, with John and Curtis, though, of course. Keep in mind, early tip time, 6 p.m. today for UNLV on the road against Boise State. I get it. It's not whatever arena it is now. So it'll always be Taco Bell Arena. I don't know why. It just always will be. But Boise State, about a six-point favorite against a UNLV team that has won four straight. Average margin of victory, 14 points per game. Rebels have been playing very, very well. Now, I do take it with a slight grain of salt. Not like very slight. They've been playing very well. You don't want to take too much away from what they've been doing. Although I will say, like three of their four opponents, 166 or lower in KP rankings. We know what's been going on with Utah State, who has lost three straight. But a good run here for UNLV. So as we talked about earlier, I'm taking the points with UNLV. I think this is going to be about a 73-70 type game. Very closely contested. UNLV should be able to have a lot of success inside. So again, Running Rebel warm-up is coming up next. Remember too, by the way, if you're not going to be near a radio, you can watch tonight. It's on ESPN3. So make sure you tune in there because ESPN3 is actually a pretty good resource for all of you. So, again, UNLV on the road against Boise State. Game time set for 6 p.m. Pacific time. So, Cofield and Company out early. Running Rebel warm-up is coming at you next in the broadcast up on ESPN3. We'll talk to you tomorrow.